formation. He's going for the corner. He's got it. Texas is back. The kicker comes through.
We're back. What is up, Horn fans? Welcome back to another episode of Fire Tom Herman, your overreactionary Texas Longhorns football fan podcast. It's been a little bit more than a month since we last spoke, and it would have been less time. We tried to record this episode last week, but unfortunately had some technical difficulties. One host who shall not be named was having issues with our recording software, and it didn't pick up his microphone, so that delayed us a little bit more than we meant for it to be delayed, but how are you guys doing?
Who would do that? Who would mess up recording?
I don't know. It was either me or you. And
I thought it was Tux.
Yeah, actually, it was Tux. Tux was the one who screwed it up. I'm Josh. You heard Noah. We're back today. Talk about National Signing Day number 2 and talk through the 2020 coaching staff now that that's finally been confirmed. So a lot of big news there, but before we really jump into anything here, before we even just start talking, the biggest news is that Derek Wareheim is finally gone. He is finally gone. The focus of this podcast, finally over and done with. He's gone.
Yeah, and you know, honestly, Derek Wareheim was kind of the least of our problems last year, but it's just definitely a meme for the podcast, and it also is kind of a good thing that we have a real tight ends coach now, and Jay Boulware. But yeah, I think that that's kind of been one of the moves that's been a long time coming, along with a couple of these other ones, and part of the major needed renovations for the coaching staff this offseason.
Yeah, really removing Derek Wareheim was less important, I think, for the sanity of the coaching staff or the sanity of Texas football fans. But really, I think it was most critical for this podcast that Derek Wareheim be removed. I mean, if anything, I just kind of feel bad for the new coaching staff because we're going to have to pick a new target. Now that Derek Wareheim is gone, we're going to have to like incessantly call for one coach to be fired. And I mean, we're going to at least have to get to the spring game before we decide who we're trying to fire for the next, several years. That.
And you know, the funny thing is, like, I feel like Giles is the natural target, but Giles has been killing it, so.
Yeah, I mean, the way we came in through the offseason, you would have thought it'd be Giles, but, I mean, you got Vernon Broughton, you got Alfred Collins, you got Sawyer Gorham Welch, you got a pretty good defensive line class. Honestly, as good as you could really hope for in the state of Texas, given the class this year. So, I mean, it's hard to be angry with Giles this year, and especially now that he's going to have support on the recruiting trail, even though apparently he's a rainmaker these days. I mean, well, we'll have to see how that evolves, because, like I said, we're going to have to pick somebody. This podcast really lives off of trying to fire coaches, and we got to find one person to be our obsession.
There is one very obvious candidate, and it's in the name of the podcast.
Well, I mean, that's true, but that's just going to be permanent. The head coach is obvious, but there's got to be an assistant that we focus on. Okay. Obviously, we will always be calling for Tom Herman to be fired. Otherwise, why would we definitely not sarcastically name our podcast like this? But there will be an assistant coach who will become sort of the target of all of our rage and all of our frustration. But the only way to find out, we got to start playing some games, and we'll lock in on someone. I guarantee that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, all those in the audience, just stay tuned. We'll find someone this spring. But so on the Oscar Giles discussion, that kind of, I think he was the main coach that was really working at signing day 2 here in early February. It wasn't early February, right? 14th.
We're recording at the end of February, who knows when any of these things happen. Time is just a construct and is meaningless, flat circle, yada yada.
Yeah, and it's not like we had that many targets either. It was really just Alfred Collins, Kevontae Dixon, Princely Umen Mielen, and
Ennis Rakestraw.
Yeah, Ennis Rakestraw. And we went 2 for 4, so that's okay, I guess.
Yeah, and honestly, probably of those guys, we got the two best of those four. Would have certainly liked Rakestraw, especially just because We're going into this class with really only one true cornerback in Keaton Crawford. And in general, I would say you'd want to have two cornerbacks. You want two safeties. You want a guy who can play that nickel. In general, you want that. We spent a lot of time focused on throughout this cycle on trying to stick with Kelly Ringo. Obviously, that didn't come through. We tried to circle back to Jaquindon Jackson's teammate, Ennis Raikstra, who shut down a lot of Division I prospect and Division I recruit wide receivers. Quay Davis in the 2021 class, he shut him down. You got Jackson Smith Njiba or whatever, who's going to Ohio State as a wide receiver. Raikstra shut him down. I don't know if he just wasn't going to camps or what, but Ennis Raikstra ending up as a three-star, given the year that he had with the competition that he went up against, I think Mizzou really got a good prospect there, a guy who's going to blow up and people are going to talk about him on draft day, like, oh, just a three-star prospect, star ratings don't mean anything. Really just to point out, like, he's going to be like a poster child for the flaws in the process, being so dependent on camp performance and not necessarily paying as much attention to what actually happens on the football field. But there's a lot of blame, or not a lot of blame, but a lot of credit can be given, especially on defense, to being able to shut down a player. Though I think it, as a cornerback being locked on to a wide receiver, a lot of credit should go to you. There's a lot of things that a defensive coordinator can do to help you achieve that. But regardless, I guess let's stop focusing on Raikstra. Let's talk about the guys we got. Kelvonte Dixon, famously the brother of running back Keyonte Ingram, comes in, four-star athlete out of Carthage, and really projects, I think, for this team and this class to end up as a wide receiver. Was committed to Arkansas for a long time. Once Chad Morris got fired, he decommitted. It took him a while to circle back, but he did verbally commit to us the evening before National Signing Day and sign his letter of intent the next day. But I think that's a pretty exciting ad, and a guy who's not going to spend a whole bunch of time on campus just being the brother of another good player. I think he's on his own, even without Keyonte Ingram. I think he's definitely a player that we wanted to have.
I agree. He had a really, really good senior year, and he's actually a lot more athletic than I thought that he was going to be. Like, originally, whenever I saw him mentioned as a project or as a prospect, I didn't realize just how much of an athlete he is. So I think that he's going to end up at wide receiver because we're pretty light on numbers there. But it's always good to get more speed at that position. It's something that Herman has talked about a lot. So he's definitely great. Theoretically, he was an easy guy to land, as was Alfred Collins, again, theoretically. So we ended up going 2 for 2 on the guys that we should have landed on signing day. And, I mean, Princely and Raikstra would have been really good additions to the class. But at the end of the day, I think we got the studs, the can't-miss guys. Because Collins, as well, is kind of a beast of a prospect there for that interior defensive line spots.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see with this four-man front that we're getting in the new defensive coordinator, Chris Ash. Really, both of the two main sort of headliners on that defensive line class, with Alfred Collins, with Vernon Broughton, what Oscar Giles and new DL coach Mark Hagan, what they're going to be able to do with those guys is definitely something to keep an eye on. With those guys, they've got the physical tools, got to refine the technique a little bit, but you have two guys who might be raw, but can definitely be molded into something great. They've got the physicality. They've got the ability. It's just a matter of coaching. And really, that's been a theme throughout this tenure for Tom Herman's staffs, is we're able to get talent onto campus. It's a matter of developing that talent into actual weapons that we are still working on that process. And hopefully, this is a staff that can resolve that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're definitely pretty loaded along the defensive line now, so I'm very excited to watch their development. And Giles is one of the guys that I think you can actually trust to elevate talent, like you're talking about. And the rest of it, it's all just, I mean, all the staff is just so new at this point that it's definitely kind of a wait and see what happens.
Yeah, definitely going to be in a holding pattern there. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's hard to judge a lot of these guys. I mean, you can look back at previous stops. And it really depends on how much credence you're lending to insiders for those programs or to fans of those programs where these guys came from, as to whether or not you believe that you could actually buy in on some of these guys. But just a quick side note for Alfred Collins, I thought his reveal was one of the more, I don't know if creative is the word for it, or if it's, I mean, sort of just weird how he revealed. He didn't do the typical hat dance. He did a sort of like a big balloon setup, almost like it was a gender reveal party. And he popped the balloon and then opened the box that was at the bottom of the balloon and put on the Texas hat. But I thought that was a different spin on the way things have been done. I mean, a lot of guys like to do the fake outs now where they grab one hat. Ennis Rakestra did this. He grabbed the Texas hat, put it on, passed it off, grabbed the Alabama hat, passed it off, and then finally put the Mizzou one on, took off the jacket, had the Mizzou shirt. It's interesting the level of creativity these guys are coming up with now to make these big signing day announcements. And I thought that, yeah, gender reveal was a risky play from Alfred Collins, especially just because it's so common already for our rivals to make fun of our logo looking like a, let's say, a gender-specific organ.
Yeah, he kind of avoided all the hat science there, because I saw people talking about Princely's with, I think it was Princely, he had like the Texas X's hat, but I think it was signed by Earl Thomas, which... it's a weird hat, but it's also signed by famous alumni, so that kind of threw all of the hat science people off their game, and Collins just avoided it entirely.
Yeah, for those of you who don't follow sort of the theories behind hat science, you're looking at when they're laid out on the table, what is his dominant hand? Where will he naturally reach first? Is one sort of more pronounced than the others? Does one look better than the others?
Are there tags? Is it worn?
Is it worn? Is it a curved bill? Is it a flat bill? Is it a snapback? Is it fitted? There's a lot of these little things that go into it where these guys, I'm sure, spend countless amount of seconds trying to take a guess just based on the hat that they selected. I'm trying to determine where these children, effectively, and these high school guys, where they're going to plan on spending their college careers.
And, of course, the term hat science is a little bit ironic because nobody actually has any idea what they're doing.
No. Everyone has theories. There are no actual rules to hat science and the hat dance. In the end, there's probably some statistical level where you can go through and try and predict, but in the end, it's going to be seemingly entirely random. I'm sure if I was better with data analysis, actually, we should get Kyle Umlong on this, get him to go through and do some hat dance science and see if he can actually pull out some like statistically significant information.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a lot of work, but you know, if somebody's going to do it, maybe it'll be Kyle Umlong.
Yeah, if anyone in the Texas fan base would, it would be him.
Maybe he and Blake and Riley can cooperate on that, do a collab. Yes.
Yeah, for the another one, for if you guys don't know, Kyle Umlong being the basically Mr. Data for Texas, spends a lot of time on Thursdays doing Aggie Fact Thursday, and then effectively his OU Sucks counterpart, Blake and Riley, also likes to troll Aggies. I mean, I don't think there's a fan base in America who doesn't enjoy doing that. But is more or less the counterpart to Umlong. But yeah, they've combined. Obviously, they butt heads, especially in October. But they have combined for some pretty entertaining takedowns in the past. So that would be something for them both to analyze. But let's move on. Let's start talking this coaching staff, because there were a bunch of hires. I think after the Alamo Bowl, the only one we already really knew for sure was that it was going to be Mike Yurcich as the new offensive coordinator and QB coach to replace Tim Beck, who has now meandered his way over to the East Coast, as all former Texas coaches have done lately. Ends up in North Carolina. He's actually at NC State, so he'll be going up against Mack Brown every year. But I think that's a good hire, as long as you ignore the dumb Ohio State insiders. A guy who spent the majority of his career at Oklahoma State, as we discussed on the previous podcast. But really, since that time, since that last podcast that we had, finally got to do an interview with the media, and he revealed to everyone that he gets off to scoring points, play calling, the pressure, and the criticism that kind of comes with being the primary play caller at the University of Texas.
Interesting phrasing for sure from Yurcich, but you know, maybe that's a good sign that he welcomes. I think that's the phrasing I'll go with. He welcomes the opportunity and the challenge of play calling. And hopefully he actually is able to take over play calling for us this year, because I think that it would be a really big benefit to have Herman off of that and more of a actual head coach and let Yurcich kind of take over.
So I'm definitely hoping for that this upcoming season.
Yeah, that'd be nice. I saw one person, it's been a while now since I read it, on the Longhorn Nation subreddit, specifically say, basically, if he walks into DKR and he sees Kleenex up in the booth, he's betting the over. So hopefully Mike Yurcich spends a lot of time getting off to those points that we're scoring this year. Running back coach Stan Drayton, offensive line coach Herb Hand, both of those guys sticking around for another year. They're known quantities, so we won't dig in there too much. Wide receiver coach Andre Coleman takes over for Drew Maringer, who finally, he was another guy, I think, like Derek Wehrheimer, was at least approaching that level where he was sort of an obsession for this podcast as a guy that needed to go. But really, hopefully, more than anything else, Andre Coleman is going to stabilize that wide receiver room. A lot of the wide receivers, it's been widely reported now, really did not like Drew Maringer. A lot of personality clashes there. And obviously, I mean, a lot of guys, a lot of detractors like to point to the production that we got out of Devin Duvernay, Lil Jordan Humphrey, Colin Johnson, and say that Drew Maringer is a good coach and should have stuck around. But I think what it amounts to is these guys were good, but there was just always that feeling that everyone else could have been better too. And weird choices like insisting on playing Malcolm Epps, who was still clearly raw, clearly didn't know how to use his physicality. A lot of guys who didn't really know how to get open, how to run crisp routes. I think that's going to be the biggest thing that Andre Coleman brings, is he's got a history of coaching good wide receivers at Kansas State. But more than anything, just settling down the wide receiver room and not having these threats of transferring like we had out of Brennan Eagles, like we had out of Little Jordan before he went to the league, like we had, unfortunately, Reggie Hemphill left because of clashes with Drew Maringer, among other things. But that's what I think I'm most excited for from Andre Coleman, is just less wide receiver room drama.
Definitely. I'm excited for the less drama, and I'm excited for having an actual coach there, which is crazy to say when you have two wide receiver coaches on staff last year. But hopefully there should be an improvement just going to one with Coleman. It's a little bit... So we can talk more about the overall process here in a bit, but it's a little bit weird that they waited so long to announce Coleman as the official wide receiver coach. Whenever he was already the interim, he was an off-field assistant for a year. They knew what they had in him. The players were advocating for him. So I do like the hire, but yeah, I don't know. The entire process was just kind of conducted in a really weird way. And I think that Coleman is kind of the ultimate example there.
And I mean, at least in Coleman's case, I can sort of feel like I can sort of understand if you went with the argument, if you were Tom Herman, of saying, well, we knew we had him in the fold. We wanted to take our time. We wanted to be sure that we could interview other candidates to see if there were improvements we could make, because we always knew that we could come back to Andre Coleman. We didn't need to move on him quickly because he's already on campus. He's already part of the staff in some capacity. To give him a promotion would not be hard. Might as well do our due diligence. I can understand that. I can obviously understand the desire to want to lock down that coaching staff sooner and not have it sort of get drawn out like it felt like this hire was drawn out. But yeah, it'll be interesting. And then finally, the last offensive coach, obviously replacing, as we've already celebrated, recently fired Derek Wehrheim, is going to be tight ends coach and also will be operating as a special teams coordinator. Jay Boulware, coming from OU Sucks, where he was the running back coach for the past few seasons, but previously played offensive tackle in a limited role at Texas. So bringing home a Texas X, always a good decision as far as I'm concerned. Hopefully that pays dividends for us.
And bringing home OU offensive coaches, as much as we might hate to admit it and want to stay away from that, you know, he had a lot of success at OU coaching running backs, recruiting running backs. So I think that that's a really good hire. I know that he's now operating in that tight ends capacity for us rather than the running back spot. But hey, if you bring in proven coaches, I always think that that's a win. And tight end is one of those spots where it's a little bit less coaching intensive, although it is a pretty important spot for our offense, or at least it has been with Herman as the play caller. But yeah, overall, pretty solid hire, I think.
Yeah, definitely one. I think really front to back, if nothing else, if absolutely nothing else changes, we have a coaching staff that I think at every position we've upgraded the guys from the guys that we replaced. Andre Coleman more for just the general stability. The coaching remains to be seen, really. But he's got more skins on the wall than Maringer had coming in. Boulware, again, more skins on the wall. And I mean, as long as he doesn't leave an upper decker at an offensive tackle's house, we're probably doing better in recruiting from Boulware than we were from Derek Wareheim. And then Yursich, if he is able to call plays for himself like he's done basically his entire career, is an upgrade for from Tim Beck. So a lot to be excited about on the offensive side, especially if you're a guy like Sam Ellinger coming back for your senior year, looking to give it one more good shot, and especially as a Texas fan, hoping that we don't end up wasting Sam Ellinger's senior year. I think there's a lot to look forward to on that offensive side of the ball. On the defensive side of the ball, made our hire defensive coordinator to replace Todd Orlando. It's going to be Chris Ash, former Rutgers head coach, and won a national title with Tom Herman while he was the defensive coordinator counterpart to Herman's offensive coordinator at Ohio State. And I thought the backlash on this one was interesting because I think if you remove the familiarity that Herman has with Chris Ash, I think most fans would be genuinely excited about this hire. I think this is a high-level defensive coordinator hire, but I know a lot of people were really hoping that Herman would move outside his comfort zone. I think the biggest problem a lot of people had with his hires from Houston was that he just brought over what was familiar. Guys who were familiar with him, guys he had worked with before, which obviously there's a lot of ways to understand why that's important. You obviously want to coach with guys you're comfortable with, but people felt like he was too reliant on that. I think that's the heart of the backlash to Chris Ash. If Chris Ash was not a guy who had coached with Herman before, people would have loved this hire. But because they were together at Ohio State, people are a little more unhappy about Chris Ash.
I definitely think there's an important distinction there, in that I think a lot of the criticism of the hire is really about the hire and not as much Chris Ash. Like you're saying, like, Ash is fine. I think he's a good hire. Even though I personally prefer a three-man front, I actually like the four-man front that he's going to be using for those people that, like, for the guys that we have next year. I think it'll be a good fit. But yeah, there's definitely a difference between criticizing the person and criticizing the process. And it's definitely an earned criticism for Herman hiring somebody within his own comfort zone. And I think that's especially true whenever you're comparing Ash to some of the other guys that were rumored at DC, which, I mean, some of them ended up not being options at all, like Morgan Scally at Utah or I think Jimmy Lakes at Washington. They both ended up, I mean, Lakes is the new head coach there. So I think that it's definitely a little bit of an unfair comparison to him whenever these other guys were clearly unattainable. But it's just, it's exactly what you said. It's Herman's default mode. It's gotten him in trouble in the past. And so I think that it's kind of a reason to be cautious about an otherwise good hire.
Yeah, but I think the thing that helps is just throughout this staff, that's really the only one where it was a true comfort hire, other than maybe Andre Coleman just because he was on staff last year. This was the only one where it was a guy that Herman had previously worked with. Yursich was at Ohio State, but not at the same time as Herman, and was otherwise in the conference, so Herman was familiar, but had never coached with him. Jay Boulware, obviously, again, in the conference, not a guy that had actually coached for, with, or under Herman. Mark Hagan coming from Indiana, a guy who's familiar with Texas, not a Herman guy. Coleman Hutzler came from Will Muschamp's staff over at South Carolina, no previous connection to Herman. Jay Vallai coming from a connection to Chris Ash, but not a connection to Herman. I think that makes me a little bit more at ease because he didn't overly rely on it. He really only turned that way for one hire. So hopefully it doesn't come back to bite us nearly as badly as it did on the first staff.
That's a good point that I hadn't even realized that he's the only guy that had coached with Herman previously. So yeah, I think that's a nice sign.
Continuing through here, Oscar Giles was the only defensive coach to stick around. We'll still be coaching defensive line. Interestingly, when you have these situations where you have two defensive line coaches, most teams will differentiate between like a defensive ends coach and a defensive tackles coach. We did not differentiate there. Both Oscar Giles and the new coach, Mark Hagan, both are listed as defensive line coach rather than position specific. Mark Hagan coming from Indiana, where he was the co-defensive coordinator and their defensive line coach. He has familiarity in the state of Texas. Like I said earlier, he was the linebacking coach at Texas A&M on Kevin Sumlin's staff, was a decent recruiter there, maybe not the rainmaker that I think there was some of, like Anwar, I think, was trying to sell it as him being a strong recruiter. I don't know if it's really that much to get jazzed about, but he's not a bad recruiter. And I mean, if we can have two solid recruiters in Giles and Hagan, I feel like that's good enough to get the job done, rather than having our previous defensive coordinator was in general probably more of a negative recruiter than anything else. Todd Orlando was just not great at recruiting, and you see the issues that we have where we're constantly looking to the JUCO ranks for linebackers. I feel like we've generally made an upgrade there, so hopefully we'll see that come to fruition more with Hagan.
I think so too. There's a lot to be, in terms of recruiting, this should be a huge win for the DL, because we were already facing a lot of negative recruiting around the three-man front. Orlando wasn't as involved as a lot of defensive coordinators are. And even outside, like you pointed to the linebacker issues, but even outside of that, you have to be involved in the other spots. And I think that's especially true at defensive line. And he wasn't as involved as, say, Elko at A&M. So overall, and again, it's funny because Giles probably pulled like the second best position group of any assistant this past cycle, but our efforts recruiting should be a lot better. And Giles did benefit from a lot of really Texas recruitments this cycle in 2020, and he doesn't have the same advantages in 2021, but all the support around him should be a lot better in the future.
Yeah, definitely to support him and to support Plutkers around Austin. So they're happy to see Giles stick around for sure. Next up for the new coaches, we got linebacking coach Coleman Hutzler. He was formerly at South Carolina under Will Muschamp. He was their linebacking coach, but also their special teams coordinator, which I think is another interesting theme that we have here, where we have Coleman Hutzler with special teams experience. Obviously, Jay Boulware is the special teams coordinator. He had special teams experience at Oklahoma. Andre Coleman was a special teams specialist while he was in the NFL, has familiarity playing there. I feel like we upgraded a lot as far as our ability to have our actual coaches supporting the special teams and making them better, because even though Boulware is the special teams coordinator, undoubtedly all three of them are going to have a pretty large role just given their history with special teams. So hopefully we'll see a big improvement there. Even if you look to the advanced stats, that really shows some of the flaws with the advanced stats that Connolly has with SP Plus, showing that we had really good special teams last year. I think any Texas fan who watched all 12 games will tell you that our return games were nothing to write home about. Our kick coverage games were nothing to write home about. And really, outside of Cameron Dicker being particularly clutch, there wasn't anything that really jumped off the page. So hopefully we're able to improve there, and able to take advantage of the weapons that we have on the team. You've got a guy like Deshaun Jameson who's now housed like two or three kicks in his short career. Hopefully be able to take good advantage of guys like that.
You know, if we can just not have negative punt return yardage 8 games into the season, that's already an improvement. Like, we had more...
Yeah, we're not asking for a lot.
We had more muffed punts than punt return yards for a majority of last year. That is just so bad and embarrassing. And of course, that's not the standard. It's not like we'll be happy with our special teams if we have 5 return yards and 2 muffed punts, even though that is technically an improvement. But yeah, if we end up with an actual good special teams unit next year, you know, our specialists are good. They're talented. And, you know, Dicker is good. Bushevsky is good. And so if you can combine that with actual well-coached units, then yeah, we could have a really, really good special teams unit next year. And I mean, that should be the goal and kind of the expectation. So yeah, I think that's going to be I'm trying to articulate my thoughts here, because that can actually be a really impactful phase of the game that people don't talk about. Like, whenever we signed Cameron Dicker, and I think that at this point, I don't think people are taking it for granted, but I think that people are forgetting how bad our kicking was for years prior to Dicker getting on campus. Like Rowland and Nick Rose missing the
Trent Domain
extra point. Yeah, it was such a struggle for such a long time. And whenever we signed Dicker, I wasn't on the podcast at the time, but that almost was, I was almost willing to credit 2018 to have one more win purely based on having an improvement at kicker. And I think that bore out whenever he hit the game winner against OU in the 2018 Red River Shootout. Like, do we win that game if we go to overtime? Probably not. So that's kind of just an example of how impactful special teams really can be. 2018 as well, the Deshaun Jameson punt return against Kansas State. So whenever you have a well-coached unit, that can be enough to win you one or two games.
And considering the number of close games that we've played under Herman, I definitely think that this is a really underrated aspect of these hires this year, is just the wealth of special teams experience that he brought on.
Yeah, and I mean, to bring it back to that, we even saw it in the Alamo Bowl. Our offense really wasn't rolling until Deshaun Jameson nearly housed that kick to get us our first score. Once we got that, everything started rolling. It's one of those things where it's one good special teams play can change everything, can get momentum back on your side, even if Tom Herman wants to pretend like momentum isn't a real thing. Every sports fan who's ever watched sports for more than 10 seconds will tell you momentum is a real thing. So to have the ability in those plays that really do exist in a vacuum, because momentum feels like it doesn't really affect returns nearly as much. Those feel like those plays do exist individually in a vacuum, but they can create such a big impact, like Deshaun Jameson's big return against Utah did. So a lot of stuff to look forward to there. Hopefully a greatly improved special teams unit, even if it's not going to be housing kicks left and right. At the very least, they'll be more consistent at giving us good field position, helping us win that battle more regularly. The last new coach we got, going to be cornerbacks coach Jay Valai, former cornerbacks coach under Chris Ash at Rutgers. He also played cornerback at Wisconsin. He's from Texas. He's from DFW. So pretty new to actual coaching so far, so it remains to be seen again how our guys do with fundamentals. I mean, if he can coach guys to turn their head back and look for the ball when they're covering receivers otherwise extremely well, I think that will do wonders for this defense. But his familiarity in DFW, I think a lot of people have been clamoring. They wanted a guy like an Emmett Jones a couple of years ago, while David Beatty is still caught in litigation hell with the University of Kansas, wanting samples back. We've wanted a guy who can really help us in DFW, help strengthen our position there. Having Jay Valai come from a DFW area high school is immediately going to help us a lot. He's familiar with the area. He's a younger guy. He's going to be able to connect with the actual players that we're recruiting out there. So I have high hopes to see what he does on the trail.
I do too. He seems to be a guy that is making a very good impression here to start off his career. Like you said, he's very young and inexperienced, and so there was a lot of backlash against the hire, like myself included. I'm willing to ease off that a little bit because early returns are good. But yeah, he's a huge question mark. Jason Washington, you know, as much as we criticize the performance of the cornerbacks this past year, Jason Washington had a better resume coming into his career at Texas than Valai does. And Washington had a pretty solid track record of putting guys in the NFL, you know, like not first round or second round, but he's been coaching like 2- and 3-star guys most of his career and at least getting them into the late rounds or undrafted free agent status. And our cornerback performance in 2017 was excellent. So it'll be interesting to see how Valai fits in. I think that he might be better at managing the room than Washington was, because I don't think that Washington was bad at it. I just think that it's very difficult to manage whenever you have three really highly rated cornerbacks that are all flashing, but nobody's really coming out and nailing down a spot, you know. Nobody's really planting a flag at the spot, at the position. It can be a little bit difficult to manage that. So we'll see how Valai manages to do it. And so overall coaching impressions, I kind of have grades. I don't know if you do, but my overall grades are like a B- for all the hires. I don't think really an A was attainable given Herman's kind of tenuous position. So I think that overall it was solid. Valai's a little bit of a question mark. But I also think that Valai is kind of indicative of my overall thoughts on the process, because if I'm grading the hires, I'm giving them a B-, but if I'm grading the process that Herman went about, I'm giving him a C, because it was all just so delayed. So I don't have the exact dates, but you have Chris Ash that, you know, probably within a week or two the firing, so you know in December that he's going to be the defensive coordinator. He, I think, pretty early on identified Valai as a guy, and then you don't actually get them in until what, like January, like after like mid-January, they don't actually start working. So I don't know, it's just, I already mentioned that it kind of took a long time, but it was also weird because some of these spots they knew pretty early on where they were going to go, and I think that part of that was, of course, the Alamo Bowl preparations. Like, you don't just want to totally displace the old staff. You have Craig Navar running the defense, calling the defense, So you can't just totally overthrow him before the bowl prep. But at the same time, you have to balance recruiting. You know, like Quentin Johnston flipped to TCU because he didn't know who his wide receiver coach was going to be. But it turns out the wide receiver coach was on staff for a year and was actually the interim wide receiver coach when he flipped. Vali, you know, we just got in on Ennis Rakestraw way too late. You know, maybe if we get in a week or two earlier because we hired Vali earlier, that gives us a better chance at actually landing Rakestraw. So I'm not going to complain about the results too much now, because I think that if you take a very long-term look at all these new hires, you come away with mostly positives. I think that it improves the outlook for the Texas program, and especially for Herman, because he was definitely on a hot seat. And I think that that's cool a little bit with all the new hires. But if you look at kind of a short term, I think that there's a lot of question marks.
A lot of stuff that's still going to be determined throughout spring practice, into summer conditioning, into fall camp. And I mean, yeah, we're going to be walking into that game. Who do we open with? USF this year. What is just going to be a lot of, yeah, it's just going to be a lot of question marks. So yeah, really, until we start playing some games, until we start having the sky falling because we look terrible in the spring game and somehow lose the spring game. Yeah, it's just going to be, I think, a lot of nerves, and I think that's really going to continue unless we do something crazy and have a dominant win in Baton Rouge in week two. I think that's really the earliest that anyone can fairly be expected to have a true opinion of the staff.
And so a couple of just random notes here, but I just want to call out Charlie Strong for being such a terrible coach that he got himself fired from USF in 3 years before we could get our revenge game against him. This year, you know, I was really looking forward to that. So I feel like that's just one last middle finger from Charlie Strong on his way out of Texas.
One very long middle finger, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Now he's an analyst at Alabama, right? He just got hired.
Yeah. I believe I saw that this week. That's the news that came out. He's in Tuscaloosa, the Nick Saban school for coaches who can't coach good and want to learn how to do other stuff good too.
Yeah. So that's kind of funny. And then one just random note on the coaching hires, and this is a benefit of us actually recording so late. You know, last week this news wasn't out, so maybe the person that forgot to record properly is actually a genius. Tuff. Here. Just throwing that out there. So Yurcich got signed to a 3-year contract at $1.7 million a year. That's $5.1 million total. Graham Harrell, extension with USC, 3 years, $3.6 million. So, you know, just something to chew on. I like Yurcich. Harrell's the only other guy I would have chosen over Yurcich, but I am very happy with the Yurcich hire. But, you know, just something to think about there.
With that, let's move on. We got really the last thing we wanted to talk about was something that came out, I guess, now 2 weeks ago. Would have been this past week, but 2 weeks ago, with all those interviews that they did, Herman confirmed some position changes for the group. I guess, first of all, one that's not really a position change, but just confirming that Roschon Johnson, there was a lot of talk through the season that when the season was over, he was going to switch back to quarterback. I think now that we've got Hudson Card on campus and Jaquindon Jackson will be here in, I mean, just a couple months, I think, he confirmed that Roschon Johnson is going to stick at running back instead. And I think that's a really good thing. I think that gives us two guys that we know we can rely on starting next season for sure, where you have Roschon Johnson, Keontae Ingram, the guys who are our 1-2 punch from last season. And then bringing Bijan in, Bijan Robinson, it frees him up to really get the chance to learn because of the whole goofy Arizona quarter system, being at a private school there, not being able to enroll early. It gives Bijan a chance to come in and not be expected to be a major contributor right away. I believe his talent will get him there and he'll see the field plenty in 2020. But having two guys in front of him that are reliable, a guy like Keontae Ingram who can typically play through injury, Roschon Johnson played strong all year, played through a lot, showed some durability. It gives Bijan time to sort of ease himself into the game, get small packages here and there, and slowly grow his role throughout the year. I think that's really good news, and I think Roschon Johnson in general just showed a lot of good potential at running back. I think it maximizes his potential for making it to the NFL or whatever, to stick at that position.
I think so too, and I think that Roschon has, like, at running back, I think he plays a very important role on our team in being able to absorb tough carries. He pass blocks well. especially for a true freshman. Like, he was really good at that last year. And I think that he is important for just going in and doing tough runs. He's really the biggest workhorse back. It's kind of weird because I see people calling Keyonte Ingram like our workhorse this year, but Ingram really isn't that. You know, like, he can be, he runs that way, but I don't want him running the ball more than 15 times a game just because he hasn't shown the ability to stay healthy running that way for the full season. And I think that last year made it pretty clear that healthy Keyonte and an injured Keyonte are very different players. So I think that Roshan is very important for keeping other guys healthy while also being a very effective runner himself. We haven't really had a guy that can consistently fill that role of giving you quality snaps while keeping the entire room fresh. Danny Young has kind of been there, but the coaches don't seem to like to play him outside of late in the game. So yeah, I think that Roshan sticking at running back is really important for that room, just to provide depth. And he's not even really depth, because that has a negative connotation. He's really good, but he basically secures that depth, even if Ingram or Bijan were to struggle with injury throughout the year.
Yeah, and you'll notice that through all that conversation about the running backs, we didn't talk about Jordan Whittington. That's because he is one of the guys that was confirmed for a position change. He is going to be moving back to wide receiver after redshirting with the injury this year. He's going to be back likely as a slot receiver. Alongside him, we also have Josh Moore, who apparently the legal situation has gone well for him. He'll be expected to rejoin the team at wide receiver. So we go from last season where we moved Devin Duvernay into the slot because we felt like we didn't have anybody at that position to now theoretically three guys. You've got Josh Moore, who has some experience playing there. You had Jake Smith, who played there a lot basically to spell Devin Duvernay this season, and played well. I think, what, four touchdowns as a freshman, and the not starter's share of snaps that he saw is really great conversion rate. And then you have Jordan Whittington there. You go from not having anybody to we have too many guys at slot. How are we going to get all of these guys on the field? Because these guys can all be weapons in a certain way. Jordan Whittington still being a big question, because, I mean, we saw him for like all of like three snaps before he got hurt against Louisiana Tech. But that's a lot of athleticism to leave on the bench. And I think that's really going to be the biggest thing that's going to be interesting to watch Mike Yurcich deal with, whether or not he can talk Herman out of constantly using 11 personnel. Maybe we're going four wide, where we can have Jake Smith and Whittington and Moore in the slot while we've got Brendan Eagles on the outside. We've got maybe it's going to be, well, Marcus Washington. Maybe he's going to be out there on the outside. Maybe Alvante Woodard finally gets time or a chance to make an impact on the team. It'll be interesting to see how that all balances out. Another option would be to have Moore and Whittington and be a slot guy if we do stick with that 11 personnel. Have those two be our slot guys, because Jake Smith looks like a guy who has the ability to play on the outside as well. Have Smith and Eagles be your outside guys. There's a lot of interesting things to keep an eye on. I think that's what I'm probably going to be watching for come spring practice and come the spring game, is what kind of formations we're using to take advantage of that level of talent.
Mm-hmm. I think that all three of them do have some of that positional flexibility. Moore and Smith can both play the Z. I think Whittington, whenever he was a recruit, I actually kind of remember some talk about him being a slot or an X. So I think that Whittington, you would probably want to nail down to one position since it'll be his first year at receiver. But I do think that there's flexibility to play around. And I do, you know, I'm hoping that, like you mentioned, this is kind of indicating some 10 personnel where we're able to get two of those guys in the slot at the same time. Because I think that that'll be a really big boon to the explosiveness of our offense. And so I also kind of want to extend your point. You're talking about Jake Smith, and I think that a lot of people kind of got caught up in some of his mistakes. Like, he had, I think, a fumble in the middle of the year, and he had the big drop against OU. But given that he was a true freshman and he was a backup playing behind the leading receiver in college football last year, he really was insanely productive. I think that almost a fifth of his receptions went for touchdowns, and he had a really good per catch average. So yeah, he's a guy that I definitely want to have highlighted next year. I think that he should be able to overcome some of those mistakes. Those are naturally going to happen whenever you're a freshman. I know he also had the muffed punt, but yeah, I'm really looking forward to him. Just adding those other guys, like you say, kind of makes a position with question marks suddenly a strength of the team. And now there are some question marks at the outside receiver spots comparatively, but that should be fine as long as we don't have injuries.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of those issues for Jake Smith are ones that are going to be resolved just by getting consistent snaps rather than backup snaps. Final position change that was discussed at length on the offensive side anyway. Malcolm Epps is formally being moved to tight end. I think that'll be an interesting position for him. I think he's a big guy. He needs to learn how to use his physicality. That was his problem at wide receiver, so that made a lot of people roll their eyes hearing that, that you're moving him to a position that demands even more physicality. But I think that's a good spot for him just because you have an entrenched starter in Cade Brewer. You've gotten guys who have seen a lot of snaps this past year in Jared Wiley and Reese Letao. So he has time to learn there without needing to be forced in. Even with injuries, there's quite a bit of a buffer, whereas it was last year, seemed like he was the first guy up once Colin Johnson went down. I think this is a good spot for him to be able to learn, hopefully learn to use that physicality, because I think that he's gotten sort of a raw deal from Maringer's management of him. So it'll be really interesting to see how that works out at that new position.
Mm-hmm. And I think that he does still have a role to play, because he is kind of our last, without Colin Johnson, he's kind of our last remaining like tall guy that you can just throw a ball up to. So I think that there's a red zone role for him. Last year, the LSU game, the touchdown catch that Keontae dropped, if you look at the formation, we had Cosme switch over to the right side, so we have an overstacked line, and Epps was actually H-back. So that's the kind of look that I loved him in at last year, just being able to put him at that tight end spot, because then theoretically, you know, you can have him just motion out, line up wide with a cornerback on him, and that's like a good setup for a fade there. You can get him single coverage. So I think that there's a lot of flexibility that he offers from the tight end spot, but we haven't really fully capitalized and found a way to like effectively utilize his skill set. So yeah, hopefully your switch can kind of do more of that next year.
For sure. On the defensive side of the ball, have sort of four major ones. We talked about how Jay Valai needs to manage his cornerback room. And you had three guys in Anthony Cook, in Deshaun Jameson, in Jalen Green, who have all played well in stretches, all played poorly in stretches, and no one's really sort of locked into their position. Well, one of the big moves, Anthony Cook looks like he's going to be moving from outside cornerback to a nickelback role. I think that's a good start as far as being able to find ways to get all three of those guys consistent snaps and let them settle into those roles that they've been trying to carve out for themselves. Because all three of those guys have potential. If you can get all of them to be effective, I think that move for Anthony Cook is going to be positive.
I think so too. I think it's interesting because Jameson has always been the guy that was projected to actually move to the nickelback spot. So it's interesting that they went with Cook. New staff probably just has new eyes and new idea of how they want the defense to operate. I do think that Jameson has kind of shown the highest ceiling so far. And so maybe they just said, you know what, this guy's athletic. We want him on the outside. We want a guy that can like match up with the elite receivers in the Big 12. Everybody will remember Deshaun's interception against West Virginia where he just mossed a guy, basically. Not really. I don't know how to describe it. He just went up and climbed the ladder. Yeah, counter-mossed. So maybe they just said, you know what, we can't mess with that. We can't take that off the outside. I do think that Cook has been the most consistently physical of the three, and also more so than Josh Thompson, who's moved to the outside cornerback spot. So maybe they're just like, you know what, Cook can fit in here. We'll see what happens. They have an entire spring to play around. They haven't even started the spring practices yet. So yeah, maybe they're just wanting to get a new look at those three guys.
That'll definitely be good. I think Anthony Cook really fit the bill. I thought last year he showed a lot more than the other two guys as far as run support is concerned. So I can understand with having him at nickel puts him in more of a position to make an impact in run support by having him closer to the middle of the field. I think that's a positive thing. I agree. Deshaun Jameson seems like he has like the best ball skills, like you said, with that interception against West Virginia. So that would be a reason to keep him outside. And I think Jalen Green is sort of the nice blend of everything that'll play well staying outside. So definitely interested to see how that works. You mentioned Josh Thompson sort of as the opposing move to moving Anthony Cook to nickelback will be outside cornerbacks. We'll see what impact he makes there. But the other big change for the secondary, safety DeMarvion Overshown is no longer safety DeMarvion Overshown. He is now linebacker DeMarvion Overshown. And I think that's a big change for him, it's been a change that a lot of people have been calling for the past few off seasons. There were some rumors about whether or not he really wanted to make that change. And I think now that Todd Orlando is gone and positions like Joker and Rover are not things in the Chris Ash defense, it sort of left... Right. It left DeMarvion Overshown sort of in a weird position of, well, where do I go? Because even with Brandon Jones out, B.J. Foster looked comfortable playing deep safety in the Alamo Bowl. So you figure he slots in there. DeMarvion Overshown apparently came to the coaches just saying he just wants to find a way onto the field. Putting him at linebacker immediately gives you a guy who has that sideline-to-sideline speed that we've been lacking since Malik left, basically, who had that ability to be that athletic. You've got a guy who's now able to cover, too, so you're going to be able to use him in several different ways. He's not just going to be able to come downhill. He's going to be able to hang with tight ends, hang with inside receivers, cover that shallow middle of the field as a linebacker. And I guess it's from NFL projections and NFL scouts, that's where scouts believe his best potential is. So I think there's a lot, another one where there's a lot of positives. We're going to have to see how the adjustment actually takes, if Overshown does like the position change that he's apparently requested. I think that's another one that I'm really going to have a good eye on. Maybe not a good eye on. I'm not going to pretend like I'm great at breaking down spring games, but that's definitely something I'm going to keep an eye on in the spring game, see how he's used in that role. A guy with that much athleticism playing linebacker, it'll be interesting to see how he adapts.
And I do think that the new defense is going to be a little bit more friendly for Overshown at linebacker. If we're going to commit to having four guys on the line at all times with the four-man front or the three-man front plus Jack linebacker, and then also another linebacker as well, that kind of is an extra guy to take on blocks and free up Overshown to really roam around and get to the ball, compared to us operating out of a five-man box a lot of the time with a nickel and a box safety. So, yeah, I think that last year, the thing that I liked the most about Overshown was that he showed the ability to find plays. He didn't always finish plays, you know, so he missed tackles. I think that he kind of misplayed on the ball a couple times. But he at least showed an ability to find the play and know where it was and sniff it out. So I think that this could be a really positive switch for him if he's able to continue doing that and can navigate through traffic, because these other guys kind of clear up lanes for him to like get downhill or, I guess, laterally and pursue ball carriers.
You mentioned that Jack position. That's really the final position change, so to speak. And really, I don't know if it's so much a position change as it is more of just sort of a change to the balance of the position they were previously playing. Both Joseph Osai and Byron Vaughns are going to be your Jacks in this defense. And what Jack is for Chris Ash is effectively a hybrid between a defensive end and a linebacker, which means they're going to be spending a lot more time blitzing and getting after the quarterback, which I think is really what everyone wanted out of the B linebacker position in Todd Orlando's defense. You wanted that three-man front, and you wanted the B linebacker who could get to the quarterback. I think the issues arose when we started using that B linebacker more as sort of just an outside linebacker who occasionally rushed more than the other guys. So I fully expect guys like Osai and Vaughns are still going to drop into coverage occasionally. I just think that balance is going to be more in favor of what we saw in the Alamo Bowl, where it just lets Joseph Osai go absolutely wild in the backfield and drop into coverage to confuse the offense, rather than what it seemed like last year, which was Osai is going to be in coverage unless we want to get crazy, in which case maybe we'll blitz him.
I am all for letting Osai just stick to the line of scrimmage because, yeah, last year he was at nickel. He was at inside linebacker. He was playing off the ball. He was covering slot receivers. It was just crazy. Right now I'm playing flag football in a rec league, and the rule for the defense there is that if you're going to rush the quarterback, you have to line up at least 7 yards off the line of scrimmage. And so I think that Todd Orlando would have been an absolute god in that league because he seemed to always love having our, whether it was Osai or a safety, but he loved sending blitzes from deep. but I think it'll be a really nice change to have Osai really just secure the edge, get downhill. He did it, like you mentioned, he did it great against Utah, but even the year before in the Sugar Bowl, he was our leading tackler against Georgia. And Georgia is a team that, you know, SEC, physical football, all 5 stars, and Osai balled out against them. So yeah, very positive change. I am excited for all these defensive changes. There's a couple of things. There's still question marks about how some guys are going to fit and how you're going to like utilize all of our safety talent. But overall, I think that everybody should be pretty happy with all these changes. And so one actual last note that I wanted to kind of talk about with the defense, and this is specifically in regards to that nickelback position. I just kind of forgot to bring it up earlier. But I think it's interesting that they've moved Anthony Cook there and they haven't tried, say, B.J. Foster. Because last year at nickel, we had Foster. We had Brandon Jones play there for a while after Josh Thompson got hurt. And so I think that it's really interesting that Ash has very early on established that they're looking for that nickelback to be a more cover position. You know, they're putting Cook there rather than like the run support do-it-all skill set, like blitzing of B.J. Foster. So that'll be kind of an interesting change to just monitor as we go forward.
Well, thanks for being patient with us during the off season, not only with our sporadic posting, but obviously with our technical difficulties last week slowing the release of this episode. Be sure to follow us on Twitter because we're getting prepared. It's about that time of year again to start posting top 25 plays of 2019. We did it for 2018 during the last offseason. Seems like it was well received. I think a lot of you who are listening now and following us now on Twitter really found out about us through that program or that series, I guess. Not really a program, not like some 12-step program like we're in AA or something. But yeah, very popular last season. We're getting ready to start that up. Number 25 is going to be posted on March 14th here shortly. We should have links posted to help for you guys to help us select those by voting on them, which reminds me, Noah, you and I probably got to get cracking on making some more streamables highlights off of YouTube there. But yeah, very popular. So that'll be our big thing on Twitter. Obviously, with it being the offseason, you'll see us on Twitter a lot more than you're going to see us posting about the podcast. Or actually posting podcast episodes. We'll also be talking a lot about the baseball team on Twitter. We're not going to get in depth here because we're a football podcast. While we're not going to be completely blind to things that are happening in other sports, seeing us on Twitter is where you're going to see our reactions to the other sports, especially the baseball team, who is currently undefeated and I think is about to have first pitch for Game 3 against Boise State here in the next couple minutes. So we'll see you in March to preview spring camp, unless there's some groundbreaking news that hits that we feel is absolutely critical that we discuss and you guys hear from us about. But until that time, hook 'em.